The Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, the Honorable General L. Frisch presiding. Matter number A210029 in the matter of the welfare of the children of BAF, TAL, AJS parents.
Morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is our second case on the calendar this morning, June 3rd, 2021. Counsel, just before we begin, I'm going to ask that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I think I said please identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. If I didn't, I'm saying it again. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead, sir.
John Mack, counsel for appellant. And that's the mother, and I will refer to her most of the time as mother rather than her name. On page 35 of the transcript, the district court stated, quote, "We had some discussions off the record about procedural matters with the burden shifting to the respondent to prove by clear and convincing evidence that she is not palpably unfit." The court goes on to say, okay, Mr. Schrader, who, by the way, was the counsel for mother, the burden has shifted. The county has met its burden of demonstrating by clear and convincing evidence that there's a prior involuntary termination of parental rights for Ms. Fernstall. And then the burden shifts to her to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that she has rebutted the presumption. But that's clearly in violation of what the court said in RBL, which said, quote, "Once a presumption arises, the burden of producing evidence then shifts to the other party to produce sufficient evidence to raise a genuine issue of fact. This standard, which is much lower bar than the clear and convincing standard shouldered by the county, is the appropriate standard." So it's clear that the district court used the wrong standard in determining that the mother's rights should be terminated. Now, use of the wrong standard in making a determination is structural error. In State versus Curtis, for example, the court said, "When district courts have applied the wrong burden of proof in the past, we have remanded to the district court for further consideration because appellate courts are not usually empowered to make or modify findings of fact." And that's critical for two reasons. Ordinarily, the problem that I have as an attorney with an awful lot of appellate cases is that the attorney below has not made a post-trial motion. If there were ever a case where a post-trial motion should have been made, this is it, because I rather suspect Judge Fisher, who is ordinarily a very good judge, would have said, "Oop, I made a mistake," and would either have granted a new trial or made additional findings, but it wasn't made. And the law is fairly clear that if there's structural error or fundamental error, as there is here, then you don't have to make a post-trial motion. And perhaps even more important, whereas here there is fundamental or structural error, harmless error rule does not apply. This court is not going to make, in accordance with its past determinations, a finding of fact that the judge should have made using the proper standards.
Let me pause you there, Mr. Mack. Are you saying that you have identified child protection cases where this structural error rule has applied to prevent an appellate court from determining whether or not the mistake in the standard of proof is sufficient, it requires reversal?
I've not been able to find one in a child protection case, but I don't see any reason why the standard would be any different.
Why wouldn't the fact that one is a criminal case involving, ordinarily our structural error case law is in criminal cases involving significant constitutional protections that there obviously are constitutional protections in child protection cases, but they differ in substance, don't they, from the structural error cases you're referring to in criminal setting?
I can't see any reason why it should differ. It seems to me that the rule is that in any case, the court must use the proper standard when it's evaluating the evidence. I don't know how an appellate court can take a look, not having seen or heard the people, not having cross-examined, for example, the relevant parties, can make a determination that the district court should have made, having seen, heard the witnesses. Take that.
Let me just pause you there just to follow up on that. If the error the district court made was failing to recognize that your client merely had to make a showing to rebut the presumption, but the district court went on to determine that the county, in fact, established your client's unfitness, which is what would the district court would have done if the district court recognized the proper standard and agreed with you that she met her burden of proof in showing that she rebutted the presumption. Why doesn't the district court's determination that there was palpable unfitness solve the problem?
Because the issue is, once the district court has found palpable unfitness, can that be overcome? And the issue is whether or not the correct standard was used in determining whether or not she has overcome that presumption. Here's one of the problems. The judge tells the attorneys at the end of the case, for the prosecution in this case, the county has met its burden. And of course it has. All it has to show is that there's been a prior TPR. But then goes on to say that the burden is now on you by clear and convincing evidence to overcome this presumption. And that's just plain wrong.
And is your argument really that when the district court makes that statement to the parties, that it somehow altered what they did at trial or what they were permitted to do it or what their case was going to be?
Sure. Say I'm the respondent's counsel in a case like this, and I have a number of pieces of evidence that I'm thinking of putting in. If the court tells me that the standard that I have to meet is a good deal higher than the one that I think that I have to meet, then maybe I don't bother to put in some of my evidence because I know it's a loser. Whereas if I thought that I had the right to put this in and I'm under a much lower standard, then I'd put it in because it might be a winner. So yes, it prejudices the counsel for the respondent and the respondent herself.
Mr. Mack, would you agree, though, that once the presumption is rebutted, the county then has the burden to show palpable unfitness by clear and convincing evidence?
Sure.
So your argument is it might have affected how the evidence that respondent put on to rebut the presumption. But here, the court still found, based on the evidence as a whole, that the county demonstrated clear and convincing evidence that that mother was palpably unfit based on her active use of methamphetamine and the dangerous environment that the children were exposed to. So didn't that, back to Judge Ross's question, didn't the court basically, in effect, during the discussion that you point to in the transcript, the district court might have articulated the wrong standard in terms of rebutting the presumption, but in its order, didn't the court in effect find that apply the correct standard to the ultimate determination, which is whether the county established clear and convincing evidence that mother was palpably unfit?
Here's the problem. Suppose that the respondent's counsel had put on the kind of evidence that he thought should have been presented under the correct standard. Then the county would have had to rebut that evidence too, not just the evidence that was put in. So the evidence that was in fact put in might have been inadequate given the proper standard to allow the county to rebut it under a clear and convincing evidence standard. It seems to me that if you look at three things, first, the mother's trial counsel was prejudiced for the reasons that I've indicated to Judge Ross. But second, we need to go into the issue that, after all, the mother had had 4 years of okay parenting time between the time that she had had the previous TPR and the time with respect to these three children that the rebuttable presumption was raised. So there's good reason to think that in a case like this, the mother might well have survived TPR. She was doing quite well until her current slip. And it should be noted, too, that she was in treatment at the time this happened. And I want to go into this in a minute. She may very well now be able to rebut that presumption if the presumption is rebuttable under the proper standard. So we're dealing, frankly, with a much closer case than the typical TPR. You have a mother who has perhaps 4 years of sobriety and certainly 4 years of unproblematical parenting. You have a mother whose slip is comparatively recent. You have a mother whose relationship with the county was not deep. Under these circumstances, a judge might very well find, using the proper standard, that that the mother has overcome the presumption. Now, I want to talk about one other thing. Like, the court probably disagrees or may disagree with my argument that this case should be remanded, but obviously there is an argument it should be. Suppose that the court agrees with me that this case is remanded. Then we get into the issue of what the court's order should be on remand. The court has a number of alternatives. It can send the matter back to the district court saying, okay, review the evidence, review what you saw at trial, and let us know whether, if you used the current standard, which you should have used, the outcome would be the same or it would not be the same. The other possibility that the court could do is remand saying, hold a hearing, not necessarily a whole new trial, but at least a hearing, to see if circumstances have changed substantially since the time that the court heard the original TPR. The court would ordinarily have this right anyway, but since... Plus,
let me pause you for a minute there, Mr. Mack. I'm trying to understand the universe in which your client would not marshal the best case possible to show that she's not palpably unfit in light of the allegations that she is palpably unfit, regardless of what standard the court applies. So if the court, and clearly the court, you know, I'll say I'm not speaking on behalf of the panel, but on behalf of myself, it seems clear to me that the court used the wrong standard. But at the outset, nevertheless, I'm trying to understand why, what logical basis would there be to support your assertion that, well, at that point, my client wouldn't have presented all the evidence necessary to challenge the county's evidence, attempt to prove by clear and convincing evidence that she remains palpably unfit. I don't understand your argument. It seems implausible to me.
Two things here. I know when I was a young lawyer, when the court came up with a determination that I found to be problematical, it would affect me into how I would approach the court. And frankly, I might have been a bit intimidated. We're dealing here with young lawyers who have just been told, no, I'm going to determine this on the basis of the standard that you're going to have to meet. And if you can't meet these standards, you're going to lose. I think that would have been problematical.
Okay, we understand that's problematic. That's your argument. But I'm trying to get a sense of how that would have affected, how that would have reduced, rather than intensified, your client's effort to challenge the county's evidence in its attempt to show by clear and convincing evidence that your client is palpably unfit, since that ultimately is what the court determined.
Because I might be worried, for example, that the court may think that I'm introducing stupid evidence, I'm making stupid arguments, I'm doing things that would irritate the court.
But Mr. Mack, if it's a higher standard than what it should be, wouldn't you be incentivized to try and put in more evidence to bolster the strength of your case rather than less evidence?
If I'm Johnny Cochran, maybe. But the problem is we're dealing with a lawyer that we know nothing about, that we know nothing about his mental processes, and we can't sit there and say, obviously the logic of it is you try harder.
Well, we can do this. We can look at the record. You can look at the record and you can point us to the fact that the lawyer failed to introduce evidence that was available to challenge the county's position. I don't see in your brief any suggestion that you found any sort of a failure by the lawyer to marshal the best case possible in challenging the county's position. Have I misread your brief? Is there something in there that I overlooked?
No, but I don't know how I would be able to put in on the basis of an appellate record what was going on in the mind or what was going on in the scrapbook of the attorney. It may very well have been there, which is probably a good reason why a new trial should be granted in this case. I have only 6 seconds left, and I'm not that fast.
All right. Mr. Mack, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it, sir. Counsel? Mr. Ranke?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Sean Ranke, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents with County Human Services. I'll start with a couple of things. First, the respondent agrees that the announcement of the district court that mother should be held to a clear and convincing standard is an error statement.
How did this happen? I mean, you know, it is very troubling to me that there was some off the record, closed door discussion about what the evidentiary standard was going to be in this case, and none of it made it on the record, and then all of a sudden trial happened. So do you know what happened here? Can you? I mean, I know it's not in the record, but maybe you can enlighten us a little bit. I mean, was there some sort of, this is what the evidence is going to be at my trial and I'm not going to hear anything else? Is there some sort of intimidation going on? I mean, what happened here?
No, I'm trying. I'm sorry for talking over you, Your Honor. It's the Zoom delay.
It's okay.
My recollection of that hearing was purely a, let's call everyone into the same room and let's talk for purposes of scheduling to make sure that everybody understands where the burden lies and what evidence is going to be considered relevant to this court. I agree that was not on the record. This is me speaking from my memory of a case that I merely observed. It was tried by one of my colleagues a few months ago.
So was that part of the discussion? Let me tell you what evidence is going to be relevant to this court.
No. I believe the discussion, Your Honor, was, this is what the court's view of the law is. When you present your evidence, try and fit that view. And I think going back to the
So then it sounds like you're suggesting...
And I think going back...
Are you suggesting that the lawyers then misdirected the court as to what the standard of proof is for the appellant?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that occurred. I do believe,
I guess what's sort of troubling to me is that it was, unless no one was paying attention, which is possible in a courtroom, that lawyers are distracted and not really listening to what the judge is saying when the judge is recounting sort of what may appear to be just boilerplate discussion about burdens of proof. It seems odd to me that neither of the lawyers would have raised their hand and said, Your Honor, I think maybe you've misstated the standard of proof and the requirement of whatever the appellant has to show to rebut the presumption, and then corrected the court and set the court on the right track. It seems like it was a pretty fundamental misdirection by the court, and it continued on that path throughout the proceeding. Correct me if I'm wrong about that.
No, I think that's a fair point, Judge Ross, and I was not the trier of this case, just as Mr. Mack did not represent the appellant at the district court level. I was there to observe, so I can't put myself in the mindset of the county attorney who tried this. However, if I were to speculate, I might say, oh, shoot, you know, I thought the standard was this lower standard. In fact, it's higher. That's going to benefit me if I misunderstood the law. Let me research that later and figure it out in a briefing schedule. I think if I had represented the appellant, I would have raised that issue. You know, it's my job as the attorney to know what the standard is and to apply it. If the court's making an error statement that's in my favor, I might not object to that immediately or raise the issue. But I do agree with the court's point that appellant's attorney should have done so. I also disagree with Mr. Mack's assessment that the error statement of the burden of proof somehow meant that the attorney presented a weaker case. Having practiced now for a few years, I understand if the court's telling me that I need to meet a higher burden, even if I think that burden is lower, I need to marshal in some more evidence. I might then ask the court for a continuance to say, Judge, I thought we were on this lower standard. If the court believes it's higher, then I need another day to get in some more evidence, some more witnesses, something to that effect.
I'm trying to get an understanding of why
I disagree with.
I'm trying to understand why it even matters. If the appellant believed it had a lower standard just to make a showing and that it was going to meet that burden, then you would automatically then shift to the next stage where the county has the obligation to prove by clear and convincing evidence that she remains palpably unfit. So I don't understand. I guess, you know, this is obviously Mr. Mack's burden to respond to this concern that I've got, but I still don't understand how it changes at all the dynamic of the appellant, and what the appellant has to show remains the same. If the burden was lower in reality than what the court required, then it seems to me the appellant would go into court expecting to win the first stage. I've made the showing. Now I've got to win stage two. I've got to defend against the arguments by the county. I guess I just don't see the prejudice, and Mr. Mack can respond to it, but I'd like you also to respond as well.
Your Honor, my only response to that is I also don't see the prejudice there. If anything, I look at it as that something may have helped me, because now I'm incentivized to put on a stronger case that if I lost, then I could bring to this court, which has to do a de novo review of the evidence presented, and say the district court erred. Not only did it apply the wrong standard, but when I brought in more evidence, the district court should have done so. And the three of you take a de novo look at the evidence presented and find that I met that burden. Send us back to the district court to make the county put on additional showings. Here, as your honors have noted in the earlier questions, the district court found that regardless of the prior TPR, mom's ongoing methamphetamine use, consistent positive drug tests, which document that ongoing methamphetamine use, along with the fact that the minor child tested positive for methamphetamine at the start of this case, all contributed to a finding of palpable unfitness supporting the termination. So
what can you tell us about the reason for the underlying previous termination of parental rights and whether it had anything to do with methamphetamine?
Your Honor. So that underlying TPR was submitted as an exhibit. It should be in the record as court record. I apologize that I don't have it easily accessible in front of me. But my recollection of that one was that it concerned I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just don't have that in front of me, and I don't want to speculate and lead the court on the wrong direction.
That's fine.
But if memory serves, it was either drug use or domestic abuse, one of those two. Yeah. But this court needs to take a de novo look at the evidence presented and take a look at the appellant's evidence presented at trial. And that evidence consists of the testimony of appellant herself, the intake social worker, along with Dr. Leo Khadijan, the toxicologist who testified as to mother's drug test results. And based on Dr. Khadijan's testimony, Dr. Khadijan testified credibly to the district court, at least, that mother was continuing to use methamphetamine despite being in treatment. So I understand the appellant argues that she had 4 years of okay parenting time or okay mothering, which then ended in this relapse. But this relapse resulted in the child testing positive for methamphetamine. And then she continued to use methamphetamine despite her allegations to the contrary while she was in treatment. So she may have been in treatment, but she was not sober. And this court can take that fact and compare it with the MLP or WLP case I cited in our brief, where the mother had completed treatment and she had done some things to maintain her sobriety. Arguably, she had done more than the appellant in this file. The district court said, I'm sorry, that's not enough. It's an easily rebuttable standard, but that's just not enough. We don't even have the amount of effort. Yes.
Can you address the structural error argument that Mr. Mack made?
Yes, Your Honor. I do agree with Judge Ross's earlier distinction.
You're suggesting that we conduct a de novo review, and Mr. Mack is arguing that the error is structural error and requires an automatic reversal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And to that, I point to the questions that Judge Ross was raising earlier regarding the difference in the distinction between a child protection or a termination case and a criminal case. In a criminal case where you're talking about some sort of a constitutional right and due process, if the jury is misled on the burden of proof or on the law of a case, that could be a structural error issue. Here, we are dealing with constitutional issues. I won't dispute that. The right to parent a child is a constitutional fundamental right. But the case law, and here I'm looking at cases like the JAK and the RDL opinions, require that when this court addresses whether or not the parent has met their burden to rebut, you have to take a de novo look at the evidence anyway. And is so if the district court erred...
And is there a constitutional right to any particular burden of proof to rebut a presumption of unfitness?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. The only constitutional right I would be aware of is the language within RDL that's been adopted in its subsequent cases that says that the statutory presumption of unfitness only survives where it's narrowly tailored. But because this court has to take a de novo look at all of the evidence anyway to determine if mother met that easily overcome burden, then I don't think the fact that this is a structural error really makes a difference. It's not required for an automatic remand because JAK and the cases like it require this court to take a fresh look at all of the evidence, require this court to come in and take a look at what mother has presented to determine if that burden has been overcome.
Doesn't that, because of so that, I presume think, that the district court applied the correct standard in determining whether the presumption was rebutted? You know, in our conducting the de novo review of the district court's determination, it seems to me that presumes that the correct legal standard was applied below. Maybe not.
It could, Your Honor. I guess I see a de novo review means we're coming in it with fresh eyes. We're taking a look at the evidence presented and saying, does this evidence rise to the level? We're not deferring to the district court's conclusions on how it applied that evidence. We're not looking at how the district court concluded. We're not giving that deference that we might otherwise give. We are saying we're taking a fresh look at this, new eyes, de novo. You can take a look at the transcript. You can take a look at the evidence presented by mother and say, it's just not enough. So you're not suggesting
that we engage in any fact finding. You're just suggesting that we consider whether the facts found by the district court or whether the evidence that mother presented is sufficient to rebut the presumption.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What is the best support you can identify in the record to support the implied finding by the district court that the appellant's methamphetamine use is related to her parenting now, not previously, but her current parenting as it regards termination of her parental rights?
Yeah, so I think if you look at the facts that the district court had, at the evidence that would be in the record, this TPR came about only a couple of months after the CHIPS petition was filed. And when that CHIPS petition was filed, the minor child tested positive for methamphetamine. That's demonstrative that mom had been using methamphetamine around the child. He had been exposed to it. It was in his system. It was processing through. During the period between that filing and the TPR trial, mom continued to use methamphetamine, even though she was in treatment. So the evidence that I have in the record, at least as of the time of trial, is that the children tested positive. They had been exposed prior to their removal from mom's care. mom continued to use, the children would have been exposed to that use, but for the removal and then the subsequent termination. As to mother's use now, I don't have any information on that. Since the rights have been terminated, I don't have any information as to whether or not she was successful in treatment.
No, I don't mean
I
now.
I don't know if she successfully.
That's outside the record. I was referring to the time of the, at the time of the TPR trial. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that the nexus was established at the time of the CHIPS proceeding, and then afterwards, there's no need to continue to show a nexus because it's assumed that if she continues to use drugs, the nexus that previously existed will continue. It'll still affect her parenting of the child and potentially the child's own secondary contamination by the drug. Sounds like that's your argument.
That is my argument, Your Honor, and I think that's also supported by some of the statements and the testimony by the guardian ad litem concerning her concerns with mother's virtual parenting time and an incident that arose there where mother had what the guardian considered to be an inappropriate reaction to an undoubtedly emotional situation, but that it did rise to on a concerning level. So with that, I see that I'm out of time. Unless there are any further questions of the panel, I thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Mack, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. You're muted, sir.
I'd like to address an issue that Judge Ross brought up, indicating that the structural error rule is applied primarily in criminal cases. It is, however, applied in civil cases as well. For example, take a look at Lumpkin versus North Central Airlines, Inc., 209 Northwest 2nd 397, a civil case, where it says when district courts have applied the wrong burden of proof in the past, we have remanded to the district court for further consideration because appellate courts are not usually empowered to make or modify findings of fact. I can't think of any reason why this kind of civil case would differ from an ordinary lawsuit.
Well, how about this distinction? In an ordinary lawsuit, where the question is, whatever it is, proof by preponderance of the evidence, district court uses the wrong standard, we're not going to find facts. In this case, the district court, as the county acknowledges, erroneously applied the burden of proof, the wrong burden of proof, on the first stage, which is the showing stage of rebutting the presumption, but then applied the correct standard of proof to the next stage, which is clear and convincing evidence, the burden on the county to show by clear and convincing evidence that, in fact, she remains palpably unfit. So in that circumstance, why isn't this case distinguished from the usual civil case?
Suppose that the court had applied the correct standard, and suppose that the court, applying the correct standard, said, oops, she has rebutted the presumption. And the court could have done that. Suppose that would have happened. Then that would have changed things with regard to what the county would have had to do with regard to its rebuttal.
How? I mean, it's all the same evidence. This is not a very complicated case. The county's argument is she was on methamphetamine. Her methamphetamine infected the child. She's palpably unfit. There's a connection between her drug use and her parenting, as shown by the child's own impairment by methamphetamine. And so that's our evidence that she's palpably unfit. And that was the conclusion of the district court, that was clear and convincing evidence of palpable unfitness. So if the district court is right, that is palpable unfitness, what more do you suppose the county would have done? And I guess, why is it your argument that the county would have shown more if what the county did show is enough to establish clear and convincing evidence of unfitness?
Well, that's not what the district court did, though. The district court made a determination that she was palpably unfit based upon the presumption, not based upon the facts. And because it did on the basis of the presumption, the court could have determined on the basis of some of the evidence we've talked about, 4 years of good parenting, 4 years of sobriety, a recent relapse, which might be overcomable. At that point, the court could have said, okay, it's easy to overcome the presumption. She's overcome it. Now, county, you've got to go back and show something else. And they don't. They just go back and show what they showed in the first place.
Why do you think the county needed to show something else? That's the part I'm lost on.
Pardon me?
Why do you think the county needed to show anything else in light of the reason for the CHIPS petition and the circumstance being pretty much the same going throughout the entire CHIPS proceeding where she continually tests positive?
Because if they don't have the presumption, then they're going to have to show by clear and convincing evidence that on the basis of something other than the presumption, she's palpably unfit. And that the court didn't do.
Mr. Mack, and let's talk about that a little more, though, because in JAK, the Court of Appeals said, if the statutory presumption has been rebutted, the district court shall find the existence or non-existence of the alleged palpable unfitness upon all of the evidence exactly as if there had never been a presumption at all. So the court is to look at all of the evidence before it, and it, and back to Judge Ross's point, I'm not clear on why it requires something else. The court just looks at all the evidence exactly as if there had been no presumption at all.
Suppose there hadn't been a presumption. Then at some point, the court could have said and should have said, even if there is no presumption here, or even if the presumption is overcome, the evidence is sufficient to find unfitness. But it didn't. And that's the reason why there should be a remand in this case to determine what the judge would have done in the absence of the presumption. It's important to look at what the court did at the end of the county's presentation, and it relied only on the presumption. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mack. Anything else from the panel? No? So thank you very much for your arguments. They were very helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement, issue our opinion within the statutory time period, and we are